My name is Desi, and I'm the Access Collective Coordinator here on All Access Pass. Welcome back to our show. Today on our show, we are going to be listening to an interview that our contributor Taylor did with Sam Turcotte of Disability Alliance BC. And before we get into any of that, here's a song. This is Blue Mountain by Florist. Enjoy!
You had fun. Do you have any friends? Well, you can solve all of your problems with a little rec. Or a big rec. UBC Rec is the best way to get involved on campus and have new experiences. Continue your fun, active, and social lifestyle by joining a team or signing up for an event. More details at recreation.ubc.ca.
So
Sam Turcotte is the Advocacy Access Program Director at Disability Alliance BC. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Taylor. So happy to be here.
Oh, no problem. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about Disability Alliance BC and what you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I talk to people about Disability Alliance BC, the way that I'll often describe the organization is as an umbrella organization for a number of different programs and services that are designed to support people with disabilities all across the province. So the program that I manage is Advocacy Access, and that's the arm of the organization that provides direct one-to-one advocacy services for people with disabilities. We have a few core areas of practice, so we help people to qualify and qualify for the provincial disability designation and understand their rights and responsibilities once they have that designation, to apply for and appeal the denial of Canada Pension Plan disability benefits, and to access the Registered Disability Savings Plan. In addition to that work, Disability Alliance BC operates a number of other programs, such as our Right Fit program, which tries to pair wheelchair users with wheelchair accessible housing. We've done emergency planning work for many years in the province, designed to ensure that emergency responders know how to support people with disabilities in the event of a disaster. I'm sure there's lots of things that I'm forgetting, but that's a good starting point.
That gives us an idea. Yeah. And what kinds of people use the services that your organization provides?
Yeah, we're a cross-disability organization, so we would help anyone who self-identifies with a disability, either physical, mental health, developmental, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Are a lot of the people accessing your services living independently in the community, or are there a lot of seniors or people living in care homes?
Yeah, so there's certainly a variety. We have a lot of individuals with disabilities who live independently in the community and are trying to do the best they can with themselves and their families. We have some people who would be living in supported care or subsidized housing. Although the funny thing with the Advocacy Access Program is that at the point that someone is coming to us to request assistance, generally speaking, they're trying to establish the presence of their disability.
Right.
So that's not to say that someone who's in a supported care environment might not want to do that as well, but it may be easier for them to do that through other channels.
Right.
So in fact, I would say the majority of people who I work with are living independently in the community. Many of the people who I work with are living in poverty and have extremely limited resources to access supports to manage the impacts of their disabilities.
The new provincial government has increased disability rates by $100 and introduced a $52 transportation supplement. Based on your experience, are these measures enough to support the needs of the disabled?
So what I'll say, you know, from the start is that if you look at the period of time for which disability assistance rates in the province were frozen from, you know, really 2007 right up until 2016, you know, we have been really, really pleased with the speed at which the new government has implemented increases to the disability assistance rates. You know, I think that if you look at the minister's mandate letter and some of the promises that they made during the most recent provincial election, they've done a very impressive job, relatively speaking, moving quickly to make positive changes. That being said, no, it's not enough. There's still many, many people with disabilities in the province who are going to be living in poverty and who are really only able to just scrape by. So, you know, I would say my view is that the last several months have been very, very positive. We're certainly hopeful that we'll be able to continue to work with this government to continue to introduce improvements and to ensure that we are eliminating poverty in this province for people with disabilities and those without.
Mm-hmm. And they have spoken about a poverty reduction plan. And that's something that is in the works. So I hope to see change on that.
Yeah, me as well. I know that the Minister for Social Development and Poverty Reduction has just convened an advisory committee which is going to provide the minister advice about how to proceed with the province's new poverty reduction strategy. I'm very pleased that Disability Alliance BC is going to be able to participate in that committee, and nice. I'm optimistic that that the adoption of a poverty reduction strategy in the province represents a very positive step forward in the political discourse around poverty.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. People receiving disability assistance used to get a $45 annual bus pass. Then the BC Liberals revoked that in place of a $52 a month annual bus pass. Most recently, the governing NDP Green Coalition has introduced a $52 a month transportation subsidy, which can be used towards a bus pass or other forms of transit, but offers month-to-month flexibility. What have the reactions been like to this latest change?
You know, the issue with the bus pass program the last couple of years has been an interesting one, because in 2016, as you mentioned, we saw the then government introducing an increase to the disability assistance rate while at the same time making this change to the bus pass program, which made something that people were once able to access very, very inexpensively, access at a significantly higher cost. And I think a lot of people in the disability community felt like this was doublespeak on the part of the government, right? So it's not that people were empirically worse off when that change happened, but it was something where this precedent of giving something but then at the same time taking something away felt really mean-spirited to people. And, you know, especially when you put that in the context of how long it had been since there had been an increase to the disability assistance rates. Now, the funny thing is that with this most recent change, I mean, in large part, the status quo is maintained in the sense that people will continue to be able to switch between a $52 per month cash transfer mm-hmm. or a monthly bus pass, but the new government is essentially returning to people the $52 that they had felt like was kind of taken away from them during that initial change in 2016. And, you know, I think that there are always going to be people who missed the $45 a year annual bus pass system. But I think that many people also recognize the pragmatism of being able to, you know, if you're a person who can't access the transit system, or who isn't in a transit-served area, mm-hmm. to instead receive some kind of cash compensation.
Yeah, of course, because it's for the whole province, and there's a lot of people living with disabilities in remote areas.
I mean, you've really hit the nail on the head. I think people in rural, non-transit-served communities were really not helped by the old bus pass system where, you know, sure, I can get a $45 a year bus pass, but if there's not a bus for me to get on and use it, I mean, it doesn't do much good. So I think when you look geographically, the system as it stands now is more equitable. And certainly I think the government has done the right thing by compensating for what people lost during the previous or the initial change to the bus pass program.
Yeah. So we sort of touched on this already, but the BCNDP made campaign promises to index disability rates to inflation, but this promise hasn't been followed through on, and people relying solely on provincial disability assistance remain below the poverty line in many cases. Disability assistance rates were frozen for about 10 years since 2007, while the cost of living continues to increase. What changes do you expect from the new provincial government to support people with disabilities?
I think there's no question that if you compare the rates in 2007 against the cost of living, for example, mm-hmm. that like what disability assistance rates would get people back in 2007 was more than what disability assistance rates would have gotten people in 2015 when you look at inflation versus the fact that rates had remained the same.
Right.
You know, people continued to receive the same amount. And, you know, I think certainly that decade of stagnation did really hurt people with disabilities. I mean, rents in Vancouver and other parts of the province have gone up and up and up and up.
Definitely.
And rates never increased, which made it really difficult for people to return to the original point of your question. You know, I think certainly this government has taken some meaningful steps already in increasing the disability assistance rates and compensating people for the loss of the bus pass program previously. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a few other things that would be really, really positive. We would be so thrilled to see rates indexed to inflation so that that long period of stagnation cannot happen again.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, merely indexing to inflation is not sufficient mm-hmm. for the long term, but it would certainly go a long way to making sure that people aren't falling behind in the way that they have over the past, you know, 8 to 10 years. The government has committed to implementing a guaranteed annual income pilot in this province, which is a model that a number of other jurisdictions are looking at, mm-hmm. and I think it's one that merits very serious consideration. And I think if implemented in a thoughtful and smart way, that transitioning to more of a guaranteed income model could certainly be of great benefit for people with disabilities and people living below the poverty line.
Definitely. Okay, so many of the programs run by Disability Alliance BC focus on helping people navigate complex bureaucratic systems, such as accessing disability assistance and filing tax returns. Why are these programs important? And do they signal a necessity for reform in the areas of accessing government programs and assistance?
Yeah, it boggles the mind a little bit how much administrative complexity people with disabilities who access government services are exposed to relative even to people without disabilities who mm-hmm. aren't accessing these programs. Mm-hmm. So to use the example of, you know, a typical client we might work with, you know, you might have someone who acquires a disability or has had a disability for the duration of their lives. And when they go to figure out what supports are available to them, they start looking around and say, well, you know, should I be applying for provincial persons with disabilities designation benefits, or should I be applying for Canada Pension Plan disability benefits? You know, should I be looking at workers' compensation supports? Is there anything that's available to me through personal injury settlements? And then, you know, in addition to some of the core programs that are available to people, you know, someone might not know, should they be looking to apply for the disability tax credit, or should they start a registered disability savings plan, or should they be applying for the BC fuel tax credit? And I mean, I guess the broader point that I want to make in naming all these different kinds of programs is not that everyone with a disability can or should be accessing services from these programs, but when you look at the number of supports that are available out there, which is a positive thing, it can also be very, very challenging because people may not know how to prioritize their energies. And, you know, I've named 6 or 7 different sources of support that people might look to. But then when you actually look at any individual program, the things that people have to do to access support through that individual program can also be extremely onerous, right? Mm-hmm. You apply for, you know, just the first thing that I mentioned, the persons with disabilities designation, and you're filling out a 28-page application, which is preceded by an online application, which is usually going to take 1 hour to 3 hours. And then if you want to apply for additional supplements or supports, you're going to be submitting another application for that. And then, you know, as your circumstances change, you're going to be submitting monthly reports. And just the sheer volume of different kinds of things that people with disabilities need to do just to access the supports that they're entitled to, I think makes a service like ours quite valuable. Now, that being said, we're a nonprofit organization, and, you know, while we're very fortunate to be able to do the work that we do, even the scope of supports that we're able to provide is limited relative to the full scope of services that people with disabilities need. The one that we have been spending the most time on recently that doesn't get covered through the government is the disability tax credit application form, which is this really increasingly has been an important source of support for people with disabilities since the introduction of the Registered Disability Savings Plan. Mm-hmm. And doctors are not compensated to fill out that form, which means people with disabilities, particularly poor people with disabilities, just by virtue of the fact that they can't pay their doctors to fill out the paperwork, may be missing out on supports that are available to them.
So there are different forms to fill out for the provincial PWD designation, and that's separate from the doctors or healthcare practitioner forms that you get filled out for your disability tax credit. Is there any sense that these systems could be managed differently to avoid some of this, some of these barriers to access?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think that the system that we have now is by no means an inevitable system. There are lots of arguably smarter ways to improve the ways that people with disabilities access supports. Maybe I'll just highlight one change recently that I think is a really positive step in reducing administrative complexity. And in some ways, it's such a simple change to make. So recently, the provincial government introduced expedited PWD application process for prescribed classes of people. So essentially what they say is if you are a person with disability and you're accessing supports through another program that has eligibility requirements that we think would also render you eligible for the PWD designation, we are not going to require that you complete the 28-page application that other people seeking to access the PWD designation are applying for. So for example, if you qualify for Canada Pension Plan disability benefits already, we think that's enough to establish that you would also be eligible for the provincial disability program. Well, isn't that a fantastic way to reduce the onus on people with disabilities to have to reprove that they have a disability over and over and over again in every different context of their lives?
Which is something that happens a lot.
Absolutely.
Even just with lay people during life having to explain why you need that seat on the bus, for example, twice a day on your daily commute.
So. Oh, goodness. I mean, disclosure is an issue all in and of itself. And, you know, the fact that people are constantly having to do that, you know, not just in the course of daily interactions with people around them, but also with all of the different support programs that they access, it just doesn't really make sense. I mean, there has to be a smarter way to handle these issues. And I think the introduction of the prescribed classes system is actually a pretty good idea, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see more changes like that that reduce the number of times that people with disabilities need to prove that they have a disability over and over again.
Definitely. And that leads me perfectly into my next question, which is, in the April 2007 report entitled Sharing Our Realities, Life on Disability Assistance in British Columbia, 11 key recommendations were made. One of these was to end clawbacks of income and disability assistance, including clawbacks of CPP disability payments and penalties for cohabitation. Could you please explain what this means to listeners who may not be familiar with the topic and why it's such a contentious topic?
It's a very contentious topic. So persons with disabilities benefits through the province are income and asset tested benefits, which means that the income that people receive from other sources and the assets that they hold can affect their eligibility for benefits. the rules that apply to unearned income are, for the most part, that unless there's some specific exemption for unearned income, it's deducted dollar for dollar from PWD benefits that a person may be eligible for. So when we talk about CPP, the CPPD clawback, what we mean is that there's no specific exemption in the legislation that governs PWD benefits for Canada Pension Plan disability benefits. So people who qualify for Canada Pension Plan disability benefits essentially have the amount of money that they qualify for deducted from what they would otherwise be eligible to receive from the province. Keep in mind that Canada Pension Plan disability benefits are a contribution-based pension plan that people have contributed to their entire lives. And, you know, I think people justifiably feel like they are being penalized by virtue of the fact that they've spent so many years contributing to the Canada Pension Plan and that they're no further ahead when they actually go to apply for disability benefits. It's a it's an issue of significant concern, as you can imagine.
Yeah, people are angry.
For many, many people. People are very angry about it, and I don't blame them, to be honest.
Do you see this changing with the new government?
You know, it's really hard to say. Every government has to make decisions about how to allocate scarce resources. And, you know, there's an important question that the government needs to answer as to whether or not, if they're looking for ways to support people with disabilities, do you do that, for example, by increasing disability rates across the board? Do you do that by eliminating the CPPD clawback? And, I mean, these are really difficult policy questions and ones that, you know, I would certainly hope that they'll continue to make changes for people with disabilities, whether or not those changes come in the form of the elimination of the CPPD clawback. You know, we'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the issue of forcing people to go on CPP 5 years early. Could you tell us some more about that?
Yeah, so the Canada Pension Plan has a number of different benefits, including CPP disability benefits, CPP retirement benefits, and the benefits that you're referring to, CPP early retirement benefits. So there's another provision that applies to persons with disabilities benefits that states that people who receive PWD benefits are expected to pursue other sources of income that they're eligible for. One source of income that many people may be eligible for is CPP early retirement benefits. So the government has historically contacted people and said, we want you to apply for CPP early retirement benefits. Now the problem is that people who qualify for CPP early retirement benefits have their retirement benefits reduced overall for the rest of their lives, which, I mean, I don't know, it feels very mean-spirited to me. Forcing people to apply for CPP early retirement benefits, I don't know that it saves the government that much money.
Yes, you made it sound very, very, very nice of the government asking, could you please?
Well, when we say,
I think
could you please do this, the implication is, please do this, or, you know, by virtue of not pursuing income that we think is available to you, we may hold your check, we may determine that you're eligible for disability benefits. I mean, you know, people are really up against a wall when perhaps their sole provider of income tells them that they're going to cut off that income unless they take some action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another issue is that people with disabilities, there's a lot of people with disabilities who rely on provincial government assistance come up against, is that there are penalties for cohabitation. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that in case they don't know?
Sure. Again, another extremely contentious issue. So persons with disabilities benefits, the provincial disability benefit is not provided to a person on the basis of the individual. It's provided on the basis of the family unit. So essentially, the ministry says, or the governing legislation says, the people in your family unit are you and your dependent spouse and your dependent children. And on the one hand, larger family units are eligible for more monthly benefits, which is a good thing. They're not eligible for as much benefits. You know, a family unit of two people is eligible for less than two single people who are not part of the same family unit, which is a point of frustration for many people. And then the other problem with that is that family units' income and assets are treated jointly. Mm-hmm. And we've already talked about how income and assets how income and assets that families have can affect a person's eligibility for disability benefits. So one consequence of that is if you have a family unit that has a person with a disability and a person who has significant employment income or income from some other source, that the income of the non-disabled person could impact the capacity of the disabled person to access disability benefits.
So let me repeat this back to you and to see if I'm getting it right. If a person who's receiving this assistance moves in with their significant other, there's no need to be married, then the income of the partner is treated as the family income.
Correct.
That's some 1950s stuff right there.
Yeah, it's pretty regressive, and there's been some really fantastic advocates who have pointed out that this kind of legislative scheme could disproportionately, for example, tend to make women with disabilities vulnerable and, you know, feel like they can't. I mean, like, my view on the rules governing cohabitation for people with disabilities is that they create a strong disincentive for people with disabilities to form meaningful, lasting relationships. And when you're dealing with a community of people who are already, I think, disproportionately likely to be isolated or vulnerable, that incentive to remain single rather than forming lasting bonds, lasting family ties, is hugely regressive.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's backwards. Not to mention that there are cost savings that come with cohabitating oftentimes.
Well, let's talk about something really weird, mm-hmm. which is that as of 2015, gifts are exempt income for the purposes of receiving PWD benefits. You can receive one-time gifts or recurring gifts, and as long as your overall assets remain below the asset limit, we would typically expect someone to remain eligible for disability benefits. So let's think about two different families. One where there's a single person mm-hmm. who has, you know, a rich mother or father who can afford to give them $1,000 a month every month for the rest of their lives, which is fantastic. Like that, I mean, no judgment against that person. I'm so glad that they have that support in their lives.
Yeah.
And then you have a person with a disability who has a partner who's scraping by on $2,000 per month who can't qualify for the PWD designation because their partner is earning money below the poverty line.
Yeah. And then two people are expected to live on one person's minimum wage job. Yeah. In a city like Vancouver, where the median price of a one-bedroom apartment is over $2,000.
I think it also creates a real risk that you are criminalizing people with disabilities in some cases who feel like, you know, who are so desperate that feel like, that, you know, don't disclose that they are in relationships because they wouldn't be able to get by
exactly.
if they made that disclosure.
So let's switch gears. On October 11th, you met with Parliamentary Secretary for Sport and Recreation, Ravi Kallon, to discuss reestablishing the BC Human Rights Commission. Why is this tribunal important for the disabled community?
So the BC used to have a human rights commission, and presently BC has a human rights tribunal. Now, the BC Human Rights Tribunal can deal with individual complaints about violations of people's human rights, including discrimination on the basis of disability. What would be novel about the reintroduction of the BC Human Rights Commission is that there would be an entity that can address broader systemic issues of discrimination in our society. You know, we know based on the rates of complaints to the BC Human Rights Tribunal that discrimination on the basis of disability is one of the most common forms of discrimination that people complain about. And I certainly am optimistic that with the reestablishment of the Human Rights Commission, BC will have an office with a little bit more teeth to address systemic discrimination. And I think that's hugely significant to the disability community.
Definitely. Do you encounter a lot of clients at Disability Alliance BC who are interested in making complaints to the tribunal?
Yeah, certainly from time to time. We have we're very fortunate in BC to have the BC Human Rights Clinic, which assists people to make human rights complaints and understand the rights under the human rights system. So typically speaking, at Disability Alliance BC, we would be referring individuals with who want to make a complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal to the BC Human Rights Clinic. So I would say that just by virtue of the fact that people know what we do in the community, we get a lot more individuals who are coming to us for help with the things that we do, such as applying for disability benefits and appealing the denial of benefits. But we certainly do have a number of people every month who come with concerns that they've been experiencing discrimination.
Just to touch on that, do you have a sense of how many people are applying for disability assistance that aren't receiving it, that are getting rejected, I guess?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, we actually spoke with some ministry representatives a little while ago, and I don't remember the exact statistics that they had provided us with. But I think it was, you know, that the percentage of people who apply for disability benefits and go through the kind of whole appeal process, the percentage of those people who qualify for disability benefits is actually pretty high. I mean, certainly we do see many people who get rejected the first time they submit an application. And, you know, people do struggle to qualify for the Persons with Disabilities designation, but it's also not something that is impossible to qualify for, particularly if you're getting assistance from, you know, someone who is experienced and understands the eligibility criteria.
Right.
Now, a big area for concern for many advocates across the province, myself included, has been that the success rates for people appealing the denial of disability benefits with the Employment and Assistance Appeal Tribunal in the last several years has been very low. In 2015 and 16, I think the success rates were below 7%.
Wow.
Which means that four people who applied for benefits and went through the internal appeals procedure and conducted an external appeal with the tribunal, that only fewer than 7% of those people are actually having their decisions or their eligibility affirmed by the tribunal, which is certainly an enormous source of concern.
Yeah, that's shockingly low. Do you have a sense of what the denial rates are like for the disability tax
credit?
Credit, thank you.
No worries. You know, it's interesting because I don't know what the numbers are globally. I actually have a colleague who does disability tax credit advocacy who tallied up her success rates supporting clients. And one of the interesting things that we found is that people who were applying on the basis of a mental health impairment were significantly less likely to be approved than people who are applying based on having multiple impairments. So what we found, this is a little bit into the weeds, so I apologize.
It's okay.
But there's a category called mental health functions necessary for everyday life, and then a category called cumulative effects of significant restrictions. And this person, this is very anecdotal, it's not necessarily the case across the board, but what this person found was that of the people she was supporting, about half of the people she had helped apply under the mental health category were approved, and about 80 to 90% of the people who applied on the basis of cumulative effects of significant restrictions were approved. Mm-hmm. So there's a really strong disparity in our experience based on the type of disability that people have.
So people with mental health disabilities are getting less access to
the disability tax credit. I think that's true.
That's unfortunate.
Yes.
Maybe that's where the Human Rights Commission could jump in and settle things.
Yeah,
that's not how it works.
we're really proud to be sitting with a group of other individuals and nonprofit organizations and professionals on a group called the Disability Tax Fairness Committee.
Oh, cool.
And it is an organization of people who are concerned that there are real problems with the disability tax credit, who are concerned that, you know, people's doctors charge them high fees to apply, and that people with mental health disabilities are struggling to qualify for it, and that, you know, in some cases it takes a really long time for people to get a decision back. And so it's certainly an important issue and one that's a priority for us.
Yeah, and I get the sense that, I mean, if we're talking about having a poverty reduction plan in place, even just covering that, filling out that paperwork from your doctor, that could get so many more people into this program, which would then get them a registered disability savings plan, which would then qualify them for money and then help people out of poverty.
I mean, the registered disability savings plan is a program that's so cool and is really different for an organization like ours, whose work has really been around supporting people in poverty, and that's work that I'm really proud to do. And, you know, people's PWD benefits, their disability assistance benefits that they receive every month, are vastly important, are arguably the most important source of support that they receive. The reason that I am so, one of the reasons I'm so keen on the RDSP is it looks past people's basic day-to-day and week-to-week needs to their long-term financial security.
Yes.
And I think that it is a plan that if used correctly over the long term can be a path out of poverty for people with disabilities. That's not to say that is going to be the case for everyone, but it is an immensely powerful plan that has that capacity.
Definitely. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know, either about people with disabilities or about Disability Alliance BC, or anything you would like people with disabilities to know?
Yeah. So Disability Alliance BC is a province-wide organization, and if you are interested in learning more about Disability Alliance BC or want to know about the Advocacy Access Program, you can contact us through our toll-free number, 1-800-663-1278. I'm really happy to be here today. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about the work that we do and to have this great conversation about disability issues.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our episode here on All Access Pass. Hope you guys enjoyed listening to that interview with Sam Turcotte from Disability Alliance BC. If you missed a part of it and you want to catch the whole episode, not to worry, you can go to citr.ca, look up All Access Pass. We post all of our podcasts up there, so you can take a look at that. With that, we're going to head out. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a great rest of your week. We'll catch you again next week, same time, 4 p.m., for another episode of All Access Pass. And one last thing, big thanks to Sam Turcotte from Disability Alliance BC for coming in and speaking to us. Catch you next week, guys.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rocking with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Wells, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, all right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up.
Oh.